If you are watching the financial headlines to, time your next property move, you are likely executing just the absolute worst strategy for your long-term wealth.
Oh, completely. It's a massive track.
Right. I mean, every time a central bank touches the interest rate dial, we see this immediate, like, knee-jerk panic across all the media.
Oh, yeah, the red Tyrons start flashing instantly.
Exactly. The pundits declare the housing market is either totally dead or surging, and everyday investors just scrap their whole strategy based on a single data point. So, welcome to today's deep dive.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to cut through all that noise and understand the actual mechanical gears of the property market, you're definitely in the right place today.
Yeah, our mission today is to just completely deconstruct that panic. Because, well, the relationship between central bank policy and property investment is almost never the direct one-to-one correlation the financial news makes it out to
It
be.
never is.
Right. So we are pulling our insights today from a really comprehensive guide on how interest rates actually influence property assets. We're moving from foundational market mechanics all the way to some really innovative workarounds.
Yeah, specifically, we'll be looking at the fractional ownership frameworks that are currently emerging over in Saudi Arabia.
Which is super fascinating stuff.
It really is. And this brings us to the hook, which is why watching those financial headlines to time your next property move might actually be the absolute worst strategy for you.
Okay, let's unpack this because we really need to get past the surface level assumption that a higher interest rate simply means, expensive mortgages.
Right, because it's so much bigger than that.
Exactly. I mean, we know you, our listener, understands the basic cost of capital, but the ripple effect of a rate hike goes much deeper into the actual creation of housing.
That is the hidden mechanism most people completely miss. A central bank rate hike doesn't just hit the retail mortgage market. It hits developer financing, mezzanine debt, construction loans, all of it. So it hits the people actually building the houses.
Yes, when those commercial borrowing costs surge, developers run their models and suddenly, future projects just don't pencil out anymore.
Wow, so they just what? They just stop building.
Pretty much, yeah. The immediate result is that they pause or completely cancel new housing starts. So, in the very moment the media is telling you buyer demand is dropping because mortgages are expensive, the actual future supply of housing is being quietly choked off right at the source.
Which perfectly sets up the airplane fuel analogy from the text, I think.
Oh, I love this analogy.
Right. It makes so much sense. When jet fuel prices skyrocket, airlines don't just like keep flying empty planes. They ground flights, they cut routes.
The supply of available seats shrinks.
Exactly. And the tickets for the remaining routes get much pricier. But the crucial element here is the inelastic nature of the demand. If you absolutely have to cross the ocean for a critical life event, you're gonna buy a ticket regardless of the fuel surcharge.
You have to.
Right. And shelter operates on that exact same principle of inelasticity. People still need a place to live.
What's fascinating here is how that inelasticity forces market participants to change their behavior rather than just, exit the market entirely. The media treats real estate as this giant monolith that moves in one
It's
direction.
like it's just one big blob.
Exactly. But in reality, the cost of debt fractures the market. The traditional home buyer trying to secure an 80% loan-to-value mortgage is absolutely squeezed. But institutional investors, cash buyers, or people utilizing alternative ownership models, they suddenly find themselves operating in an environment with significantly less retail competition.
They are basically playing a completely different game on the exact same board.
That's a great way to put it.
I have to challenge the core premise of the source text here, though.
Okay, let's hear it.
Let's look at the pure math of purchasing power. If the national borrowing rate jumps, say, 200 basis points, a buyer's debt-to-income ratio hits the ceiling. They physically cannot qualify for the same loan amount they could 6 months ago.
That's true.
So either transaction volume drops to zero, or sellers are forced to take a massive haircut on their asking price just to clear the inventory. Basic market clearing mechanics dictate that high rates have to equal crashing prices. How does the text reconcile that math?
Well, the math you are describing is perfectly sound in a vacuum, but it totally fails in reality because it treats demand as the only variable.
Ah, right. The supply side.
Exactly. It completely ignores the localized supply bottlenecks we just discussed. Property values are not tethered exclusively to a national interest rate. They are intensely, stubbornly local.
Stubbornly local. I like that.
It's true. I mean, if we look at a metropolitan area experiencing, say, a 5% year-over-year job growth, but regulatory zoning or construction pauses mean the housing supply is only growing at 1%, well, the national interest rate becomes completely secondary.
So the macro debt environment is heavily outweighed by the micro scarcity.
Emphatically, yes. There are simply more human beings who need beds than there are beds available in that specific zip code. So sellers in that environment do not have to drop prices to accommodate the buyer's shrunken mortgage capacity. Because there are still enough buyers, often those cash buyers or institutional funds we mentioned, willing to clear the limited inventory. The price action defies the national trend entirely.
Which brings up the other side of the ledger. The source text details a really fascinating secondary effect of this affordability crisis, which is the rental pivot.
Yes, the rental pivot is huge.
Let's mechanically trace the life cycle of that sidelined retail buyer we just talked about, the one who got priced out because their mortgage pre-approval shrank by 20%.
Right, so when those buyers are forced to delay their purchasing decisions, their need for shelter doesn't just evaporate.
They still need that airplane ticket.
Exactly. So they pivot immediately into the long-term rental market.
Yeah.
And because this is happening at scale across an entire demographic of would-be first-time homebuyers, you see this massive sudden influx of highly qualified renters competing for existing inventory.
And that compounding effect is where the yield math completely changes for an investor.
It really does.
The very interest rate hike that paralyzed the traditional buying market aggressively drives up rental demand, pushing lease rates higher. For an investor focused on yield, you know, the actual cash flow the property generates relative to its price, this high-rate environment is incredibly lucrative.
It is. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it exposes the flaw in the speculator's mindset.
Mm-hmm.
If your entire strategy is holding an asset and just, like, praying for capital appreciation, a high-rate environment is terrifying.
Well, for sure. You're sweating.
But if you are managing a portfolio for consistent growing cash flow, those high rates are actively pushing your target demographic into your properties and allowing you to increase your margins.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because capitalizing on that rental demand requires discipline. The text explicitly warns about the inverse scenario, which is the absolute trap of buying property just because debt is cheap.
Oh, this happens all the time.
Right. If an investor secures a historically low mortgage rate, the monthly math might look really appealing on a spreadsheet. But if they lock in that cheap debt on an asset in a declining neighborhood with poor job retention, they haven't made a savvy investment. They've just cheaply financed a liability.
It is the most common pitfall in real estate. Cheap money acts as a camouflage for terrible assets.
That's a great quote.
Yeah, sophisticated investors do not use the central bank's benchmark rate as their primary acquisition trigger. They underwrite the asset based on fundamentals that will outlast the current debt cycle.
Let's get specific on those fundamentals. Instead of obsessing over the news ticker, what mechanical data points are institutional investors actually measuring to determine long-term viability?
So they are analyzing infrastructural capital expenditure. Like, is the local government actively funding a new transit hub?
Okay, that makes sense.
They're looking at absorption rates for new commercial leases, which indicates future job density. They evaluate the diversity of the local employment base. I mean, if a city relies on a single industry, it's highly volatile.
Right, like a factory town.
Exactly. And they are mapping out municipal development master plans for the next 10 to 15 years. Those localized data points dictate the true performance of a property far more than whatever the central bank decides to do on a Tuesday in November.
I really want to ground this for you, the listener, and apply it to how you process financial information. The text uses the Saudi central bank, which is known as SAMA, as a prime example of this dynamic.
It's a perfect case study.
Yeah. A retail speculator monitors SAMA's policy announcements to try and, like, day trade real estate, hoping to catch a rate drop to flip a property. But real estate is far too illiquid and transaction costs are far too high for that to ever work mechanically.
No, it never works. An informed investor, however, reads those same SAMA announcements entirely differently. Well, they use them to measure the velocity of money in the broader economic environment. They want to understand the overarching monetary policy so they know the macro context. But they still execute their capital deployment based strictly on those local infrastructural and employment fundamentals we just outlined.
So if cheap debt is a trap that tempts bad investments and expensive debt kills the cash flow on good investments, the traditional retail investor is essentially paralyzed.
Pretty much caught between a rock and a hard place.
Right. They are entirely dependent on timing the macro bet cycle, which we just established is a terrible strategy. So does the source offer a structural way to break out of that traditional borrowing bottleneck?
It does, and this is where the modern real estate landscape is rapidly innovating. The text points to fractional property ownership as the specific blueprint to bypass this exact dilemma.
Okay, fractional ownership.
Yeah. It structurally separates the act of acquiring real estate from the necessity of leveraging high-interest debt.
Let's break down the actual mechanics of how that fractionalization works, because it's distinct from just buying into a massive, opaque real estate investment trust, or REIT.
Definitely distinct. With traditional real estate, the barrier to entry is the massive down payment and the subsequent heavy mortgage. In a direct fractional model, a specific income-generating asset is placed into a special-purpose vehicle, or an SPV.
Okay.
This is a distinct legal entity created solely to hold that one property. The equity in that SPV is then divided into shares.
So instead of taking out a massive loan to buy a $2 million logistics warehouse, you can deploy $10,000 in cash to purchase shares of the SPV that holds that specific warehouse.
Exactly the mechanism. You gain direct exposure to the underlying real estate, you receive your proportional distribution of the rental yield, and you participate in the capital appreciation of that specific asset.
Without the mortgage.
Crucially, yes. You do it entirely without taking on the personal burden of a high-interest mortgage. You bypass the lending market completely.
And this model inherently solves the diversification problem for the individual investor, too. I mean, if you buy a single-family home the traditional way, a massive chunk of your net worth is tied to the hyper-local performance of one street corner.
Which is incredibly risky.
Very. But by fractionalizing your capital, you can own unleveraged equity in a residential complex, a commercial retail space, and maybe a medical facility, spreading your risk across different asset classes and geographies.
And the sources highlight Saudi Arabia as a prime testing ground for this evolution, specifically pointing to a platform called Usul Gamma.
Yes, Usul Gamma.
And what makes this case study vital is the regulatory environment it operates within. Usul Gamma isn't operating in some unregulated gray market. It is actively integrated into the Real Estate General Authority's regulatory sandbox, known as REGA.
Let's actually define what a regulatory sandbox is, because that term gets thrown around in fintech constantly.
It really does.
Mechanically, it is a formalized legal testing ground created by a financial regulator. REGA essentially draws a perimeter and allows a company like Usul Gamma to test their fractional investment platform with real consumers and real assets. But they are temporarily exempt from certain legacy banking and securities regulations that would normally crush a startup on day one.
Right. And this raises an important question about institutional adoption. Why would a regulatory body like REGA take the risk of setting up this sandbox?
Why let them bend the rules? Right.
Exactly. It's because they recognize that legacy financial laws are stifling necessary innovation. By observing Usul Gamma operate within this controlled environment, the regulator can see exactly how the technical plumbing works.
Like how the SPVs are managed.
Yes. How the yields are distributed, how consumer funds are protected, all before they write permanent nationwide legislation.
It ensures that when this fractional framework scales, it does so with robust legal protections, integrating safely into the broader financial system rather than acting as a shadow market. It's just a brilliant way to incubate alternative ownership models, especially in a region aggressively pursuing economic diversification like Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030.
The implication for the individual investor is profound here. If you can access institutional-grade real estate assets through highly regulated fractional platforms without needing a mortgage, the central bank's interest rate suddenly loses its dictatorial power over your portfolio.
So what does this all mean for how you build your strategy today? Does fractional ownership give you a free pass to ignore the macroeconomic environment entirely?
The text argues a resounding no.
Yeah, the fundamental laws of real estate still govern the asset. If you buy a cash fraction of a property in a declining city with terrible infrastructure, you just own a debt-free slice of a terrible investment.
Precisely. The underlying asset still has to perform. Rental demand, local job growth, the quality of the property management facility, these variables remain paramount.
They don't just go away because of the SPV.
No, not at all. If the broader economy contracts and a region loses its major employers, your fractional property will struggle to maintain occupancy and your yield will collapse, regardless of how innovative the SPV structure is. The fundamentals are non-negotiable.
But what this structural shift does accomplish is returning agency to you as an investor. You are no longer sidelined by the cost of debt.
That's the key takeaway.
You have a mechanical tool to continue dollar cost averaging into a diversified real estate portfolio, regardless of whether the benchmark borrowing rate is at 2% or 8%.
It fundamentally untethers your ability to invest from your requirement to borrow. For decades, those two actions were inextricably linked for the average person. Breaking that link is a massive paradigm shift.
It really is.
It permanently removes the excuse of waiting for the macroeconomic weather to clear up before you take action.
So to synthesize the core mechanics of everything we've explored for you today, interest rates are a heavy lever in the economy, yes. They dictate the flow of institutional capital and the pace of new construction. But they are not the sole arbiters of property value.
Not even close.
You cannot let a dramatic headline about central bank policy derail a strategy built on local fundamentals.
Markets are ruthlessly adaptive ecosystems. When the traditional mortgage door slams shut, the demand doesn't disappear, it reroutes. It surges into the rental market.
Like water finding a new path.
Exactly. The investors who build generational wealth aren't the ones trying to predict the Federal Reserve or SAMA's next move. They are the ones who understand how to read the localized supply and demand imbalances of the present moment and utilize the right financial vehicles to capitalize on them.
Which leaves us with a final, highly specific thought for you to explore on your own today. A concept that really builds on the mechanics of everything we've discussed. We established earlier that when high interest rates make mortgages toxic, massive amounts of would-be traditional buyers are forced into the rental market.
Yep.
We also established that this localized surge in demand aggressively drives up rental yields.
Where does that math lead us?
Consider the inverse logic. Could a high interest rate environment actually be the optimal, absolute best time to deploy capital as a fractional investor in rental properties?
It's a fascinating thought experiment.
Think about the board right now. The traditional retail buyers are completely paralyzed by expensive debt. The developers are pulling back on new supply. But as a fractional investor utilizing a platform like Usul Gamma, you aren't reliant on that debt.
You're immune to it.
You are acquiring unleveraged equity in cash. You get to absorb the surging rental yields driven by the sidelined buyers, all while facing significantly less acquisition competition. You are essentially leveraging the broader market's macroeconomic fear to generate superior debt-free cash flow.
You are stepping into the exact void created by the traditional market's reliance on leverage. It's a masterclass in structural arbitrage.
It completely flips the narrative. You aren't just surviving a high-rate environment. You are structurally designed to thrive in it.
Absolutely.
It really reinforces the idea that when you step back and look at the actual plumbing of the financial system, the landscape isn't as murky as the headline suggests. It's a complex mechanical ecosystem. And once you understand how the gears actually turn and how to bypass the ones that are stuck, the path forward becomes incredibly clear.